Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. This week, we'll be talking with a blind writing instructor, author, and musician.
We'll speak with Emily Michael, whose work has appeared in many publications and focuses on creative nonfiction topics such as disability, music, education, and ecology. We'll speak with her about her work and how she has overcome challenges in employment to get published and work successfully in the classroom. But first, for a tip of the week, this week's tip comes from Emily.
I would say find your tribe. Find the people who encourage you. Find the people who are willing to sit down with you and look at your work seriously. I've often found that, I've talked to authors who have published way more than I have, and even when the work I show them isn't good, they have found a way to encourage me. And I've found that if someone can't encourage you, they're probably not worth listening to. Brené Brown has this great quote about, if you're not in the arena, you don't have the right to judge. You know, I think about people who are so much more experienced than I am, and they have so many more publications than I do, and they've never once made me feel small. And so I think if you can find the people who don't make you feel small, but who see the work that you're trying to do and they want to help you do it, then you'll be successful.
And in the rest of this show, we'll speak with Emily about some tips she has for aspiring authors and people who want to teach, and some of the challenges she's had to overcome in her aspirations to be an author and a college instructor.
And I'd just like to add that what Emily said applies to so many people in so many different endeavors, whether it's professional or personal or a hobby or any interest. I think what she says applies universally. Let's start by meeting Emily.
My name is Emily Michael. I'm a blind poet, musician, and college writing teacher living in Jacksonville, Florida.
And I take it you had limited vision when you were young, but you lost your vision at a very early age.
Yes. Yeah. Congenital. Absolutely. I've always had low vision, and I use the term blind because it's more useful to me. Most people, if they hear low vision, they start trying to relate to me visually, and that's problematic. I mean, then they start going, well, how much can you see? You know? And so I just say, hey, I'm blind. That's easier.
At times, I've almost had the opposite experience.
Really?
So I had some vision when I was younger, but these days I'm totally blind, and I wear glasses for protection. Mm-hmm. And I'll meet some new people sometimes, and I'll tell them that I'm blind, and they say, yeah, I can't see anything either. So people take different connotations from the word blind and low vision.
They do, absolutely.
I understand you also use a guide dog. What's the name of your dog?
His name is York. And he's a black lab, and I've had him for about 2.5 years.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
This week's focus topic is Emily's work as a poet, essayist, and writing instructor.
So you introduced yourself as a poet and writer and teacher. Can you tell us a little bit about what types of things you write?
Lately, it's been a lot of poetry. I think of myself as a poet first. So in my spare time, if I start writing, it's usually a poem. But I have written several essays, a lot of creative nonfiction, a lot of narratives. And then I spent a short time blogging for Minnesota Public Radio, doing work on musical journalism, like book reviews, concert reviews, essays about singing. I also like to sing. So I find that my writing tends to center on the same themes over and over again: disability, music, education, ecology. But it's mostly, I would say it's mostly poetry.
And I take it you've been doing this for some time. You've been published in many places.
About 4 years. I started publishing in 2012. I graduated with my master's in English, and I freaked out. thinking, you know, oh my God, what's next? And a faculty member passed along a call for essays by disabled students. And I thought, well, I can do that just to stave off the inevitable breakdown of graduating and not knowing what to do with your life. So I started to write an essay, and then it's actually the first piece that was ever accepted, but it has yet to be published. It's coming out in a textbook next year. But since then, it's been poetry, essays. I mean, I'm actually surprised by how often my work is accepted, because to me, it's always been this thing that I do for myself. And then I had a few friends that would be interested, you know, but it still kind of blows me away that people like it. I mean, not that I don't like my own work, but I guess I'm surprised that it's gotten such a wide reception.
My impression is that it's quite a challenge to be published, especially as a new author.
I think it is. And I think the reason I've been successful is I found places that are looking for writers like me. I think that I've been successful because I found little niche journals, you know, that are looking for what I'm offering in a lot of cases.
And what are some of the publications in which your work has appeared?
There's Word Gathering, Breath and Shadow, The Femme, which is an online journal of feminist writing. I recently had an essay in a collection called Mosaics, a collection of independent women. That was actually a second volume of an indie anthology of women's writing. The Deaf Poets Society just took one of my poems for their inaugural issue. They have just gotten started, so that's kind of exciting. Let's see. I sent an essay to, there's a nonfiction journal called Brevity, and they have a blog. And so I sent them an essay, and they published it on their blog. A couple of local magazines, one called Bridge 8, which is a local magazine that they've just expanded to take in writers from all around the country, but they used to just publish Jacksonville writers. And then another magazine called the Saw Palm Literary Review has just accepted one of my pieces as well.
This is a long list of publications to which you've submitted your work, and maybe you've even submitted to additional ones. Do you find that you get any pushback because you're blind?
Yes and no. I've been very careful about where I've submitted my work. In fact, I did a piece for Word Gathering, and I called it a stylish negotiation, because it was about all of these websites that claim that they want stories by blind writers. But then when you go look at their guidelines, they say, well, don't use the word blind. Remember that your audience is sighted, you know, and they give you all kinds of rules about how to shape your story, and they can kind of inhibit your creative process. And so I've been lucky in that I've had really good experiences with journal editors, but I've had a few negative experiences where the editor told me to change something fundamental about the piece that felt very inauthentic to me. And so in that case, I usually said, I'm going to withdraw the piece. I think on my end, I censor myself a lot, in the sense that I don't often submit to places if I get the sense that they're not looking for disabled writers. And then have been a few cases where I've submitted something and thought, this piece is really strong, and then it's just been rejected. And I do have to wonder, are they uncomfortable with the blind thing? In one case, I submitted to a collection of essays on music, and I felt that my essays were really strong, but they were pretty nuanced in their handling of disability. And I know that that's not what they were looking for. I think they were looking more for an inspirational.
So you mentioned that you teach writing skills at a local college. What was it like getting that job? Was there any reticence on the part of the people hiring you about hiring a blind person?
There wasn't. I got really lucky. I work at the college where I had done my graduate work, so they knew me. You know, I like to think that that kind of set some of their worries aside. But I've gotten lucky in the sense that my boss has always said, you know, here's the curriculum, but whatever you need to adapt, just do it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. I also teach at another community college. And when I went in for that interview, I had been recommended by a friend. And so the boss definitely looked at me and said, oh, your friend didn't say you were blind. He really didn't have a problem with it, but he was embarrassed about doing something wrong on his part. Because we talked through it, and I said, well, it's not really her place to tell you that I'm blind. And he said, look, I didn't want to make you uncomfortable. I wanted to make sure that you had what you needed. He didn't have an issue with my skills. I think it was just a little bit of social awkwardness. But I feel that I've gotten lucky, because at both places, there's never been an issue.
Yeah.
I mean, they just seem to be willing to work with me. And I know that's not usually the case.
Well, I guess in the one case, they were already familiar with you and your successful operations, as you said. And in the other case, it was kind of a surprise. On the other hand, blindness wasn't a qualification or not a qualification for the job. So there really was no sense to bringing it up until you met the person who was potentially hiring you.
Exactly.
I assume that by the time they brought you in for an interview at the second college, that they had already received recommendations and that they would have some indication from the first college of what quality job you could do.
That's true. And they also had my CV. And I have, I mean, if you look at my list of publications, many of them deal with disability. So I don't think it should come as a huge surprise. But maybe they didn't really look too closely at that.
So you sound like a very capable and ingenious person, but I'm wondering what kind of challenges or obstacles that you might have had to overcome in the classroom with students, reading papers, correcting papers, or just interacting with the class in general?
There have been a few behavioral issues. And mostly, I think it really wasn't about me. It was more about the student at the time. I'm thinking of one student in particular who kind of tried to make the usual blind jokes, you know, like, oh, if we're all really quiet, she won't know we're here. So I would say the biggest challenge for me has been the occasional student who thinks that they're very clever. But what's surprising to me is that the rest of the class never goes with it. I mean, I've never had an entire class, you know, turn on me like that. So I want to say that that's not really about me. You know, usually that's about that student needing a lot of attention or feeling some kind of need to overcompensate.
Right. It's interesting that you say the rest of the class won't in general go along with that. And I was going to ask you if there was some peer pressure involved in kind of policing that kind of automatically. And it sounds like that worked.
I think so. I think they kind of looked at him askance and said, you know, what are you doing? That's not appropriate.
Peer pressure is a wonderful thing. It can be a positive experience many times.
It is.
When we were students, which was a long time ago, we had to submit our essays as written on a typewriter. I assume these days people submit their essays electronically and you have no trouble reading them?
Yes. I also have them print in size 18. So I like to grade printed copies, but I can also grade digital copies.
Well, that works. So that sounds like a lot of fun. It must be a lot of fun teaching. I can imagine that's a very rewarding experience.
It is. I love it. I mean, it's the kind of thing where you spend your Friday nights thinking of new ways to teach things, you know?
And your students are spending their Friday nights hurrying to write the essay that's due Monday morning so they can go to the parties.
Well, exactly. So, but I love it. And honestly, my favorite classes are the students who struggle the most. I love the students who can barely write or, you know, they're called remedial or, you know, exceptional. And I just have so much fun thinking of ways to teach them.
So we went to your blog earlier, and you have some very interesting content on your blog. It's not in general about you or your writings. Can you tell people what's on your blog and how it got started to be that way?
Well, it was originally just a place where I could practice writing well. I thought I've got to have an outlet, you know, because at the time I wasn't publishing very much. And so I thought, well, I'll just start writing about things that matter to me. And then I kind of expanded it to be more of a professional page. There's a resource page for disabled writers. There's a page full of articles and links that I really enjoy, you know, lectures, blog posts, other blogs that I follow. And then for the whole month of October, which is Blindness Awareness Month, I do a series of interviews. So I send general questions out to friends, acquaintances, colleagues that are blind, and whoever wants to answer them can. And so what you'll see if you go to the main blog page is you'll see several posts that say, you know, October interview. And they're all different perspectives from other blind people. Some of them are professional academics. Some of them are teenagers. Some of them are other students in all different fields, psychology. One person studies, you know, Near East medieval literature. So I've tried to provide as wide a cross-section of perspectives as I could.
And that can be a great resource. I mean, that's partially what we try to do with this show here. Some of our shows are about new technologies and new ways of doing things, but a lot of the shows are just stories about other blind professionals, blind people doing interesting things that you wouldn't normally think a blind person would be involved in, and just to share these stories and show people what's possible and the breadth of different kinds of opportunities that are available to people who are visually impaired or blind, I think is a wonderful thing.
I think so too.
And we cover not only a wide variety of professions, but also a wide variety of pastimes and athletic endeavors and all sorts of things. You know, you're always running into somebody who's recently lost their vision and they say, oh, I used to like to do this. And whether it's cooking or knitting or hiking or being a professor, and now I can't because I can't see. And to be able to tell them, well, this person figured out how to do it, maybe you can get some ideas of how you can do it also from listening to what this other person had to say.
Exactly.
I think those examples of success can just open people's minds and create some opportunities.
Well, it's funny. I have two students this semester who are both visually impaired, and they're in separate classes. And both of them said, I never expected to have a blind professor. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting that even they don't expect me to be here, you know? So sometimes it's just about showing people that it can be done. And it doesn't mean that it's easy, or that every day is, you know, a festival and you're always cheerful, but I think it can be done. It's hard for me to imagine a profession that a blind person couldn't do, maybe being an air traffic controller or, you know, a neurosurgeon, but I really think it can be done.
Well, that's great. And some of those students might even think that it might be possible to be a blind college professor, as you've done.
Exactly.
So you talked about your guide dog, York, and I know you've written pieces about guide dog etiquette. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely. So the general etiquette for guide dogs is don't pet them, don't look at them, and don't talk to them. Every dog is different, so some owners will allow you to pet their dog, or it's okay if you talk to their dog. But mine is a big flirt. He's a big social butterfly. So anytime we're out and anybody gives him the slightest bit of attention, he wants to be their new best friend. And I used to travel with a cane. I traveled with a white cane for quite a while. So getting the dog was a big change. And it was a big change in all the ways you expect. It was easier to get around. I felt more confident. You know, the traveling was better. But it made my life so much more social because everybody wants to stop and talk to a dog. Nobody wants to stop and talk to a cane. So it's been a challenge for me to learn to be patient and to respond gracefully to what can be intrusive comments. Sometimes the questions are intrusive. Sometimes people talk to the dog and not me, you know, or they ask me questions that seem a little personal, like someone who I don't know will say, so how much vision have you lost? I want to say that's not really any of your business, you know?
Right.
But overall, though, I would say the interactions are mostly positive. Most of the time, it's people who just love animals. And my dog is gorgeous. He's a very striking, handsome guy. And people want to come up and talk to him all the time.
We've heard that from other users of guide dogs, that interactions can be a little bit more social. But you didn't know that ahead of time. I'm wondering how you made the decision to change from a cane to using a guide dog? What went into your thought processes?
I knew a couple of friends who had dogs, but the only thing I can really say is, I guess it's like when you decide you want a baby. I'm not a mother, but I feel like it's the same feeling. You just decide you want one. And then all of a sudden, everywhere you look, there are people with their guide dogs and you think, I want one. And then It's like, you can't get it out of your head. It doesn't seem like a particularly logical choice, or at least for me, it wasn't. I knew that it would help me travel better, but I didn't know how much better. I just knew that it would be an improvement. I thought maybe I'd be more adventurous and then I would feel more freedom. Maybe I'd be willing to try a new way of getting around a familiar place rather than just sticking to the paths that I had already memorized. But when I really think about it, it was not a logical choice. It's just like, I just knew that I wanted a dog.
And have you found that to be true, that it does open up other opportunities and made you be more adventuresome where you go?
Absolutely. the funny thing about my dog is that he likes to be challenged. So when I used to travel with a cane, I would choose the least crowded path so that I wasn't tripping people up, you know. But with the dog, he gets bored if it's not challenging enough. So I have to choose a more crowded area so that he's interested and engaged because he likes to show off.
Oh, interesting.
I do feel that I choose different paths now, or if I get turned around, I don't tend to panic. And I wasn't panicky before, you know, but now it's just like, oh, we'll figure it out. I do feel that I've been much more adventurous with him.
So you also mentioned that another one of your passions is music. What do you do musically?
I sing.
Do you sing with a group?
I used to. I used to sing with a barbershop chorus, actually. And then I had a quartet for a while. But I was trained classically, so I've spent many years singing classical choral music. And then I spent about a year singing some opera and jazz. I'll sing anything, really.
Do you use Braille music for that? How do you follow along with the lyrics and, you know, do sight reading?
It's a challenge. I can sight read vocal music, but I can't read lyrics and notes at the same time. I have tried to learn Braille music, but I found it kind of intimidating. I really need to sit down with it and spend more time with it. Because I would like to learn Braille music, but for now I'm able to sight read. But generally when I was in chorus, I would learn my music and get off the paper as quickly as I could and then memorize. So, and then when I was taking voice lessons, I did the same thing. I would, you know, sometimes I would find the lyrics separately, like type them up separately or copy and paste them from a web page. And then I would deal with just the music and I would memorize the lyrics apart from that.
So it sounds like with a little extra work and some modifications, this worked out pretty well.
It did.
I understand that you recently gave a TEDx talk. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Absolutely. So the topic of my talk was the confluence of disability and imagination. My goal was to take the non-disabled listener or even the disabled listener through what it's like to be a blind person in today's world. And I talked about how oftentimes when people meet me, they expect me to be a particular character rather than who I really am. So there are usually three options. There's the victim, there's the superhero, and there's the unspeakable. And the victim is the person who's overcome by their disability. You know, blindness is the reason their life is over. And the superhero is the person who won't let anything stop them, and they're unrealistic, and they're a perfectionist, and they're afraid to show that blindness might be an issue. And then the unspeakable is the person who just doesn't talk about their disability because it's just too shameful or too awkward. And so in that talk, I challenged my listeners to let me tell my own story and to get rid of these three tropes because they're exhausting and they're limiting. And I wanted to just be myself and to recognize that we're not all going to live our disabilities the same way, but they're not shameful and they're not tragic. They don't have to be blessings in disguise. Sometimes they can be a real pain, and that's okay. That there doesn't have to be one story about what it's like to be a blind person. What we need instead is the sense that we can all come forward and share our stories.
Well, those are great thoughts. It seems like we do tend to want to categorize people and often have some severe preconceived notions about other people. So it's good to break down those barriers and open up people's minds.
Exactly.
And here's an example of Emily's poetry as she reads it.
Crushed. Forgive her, comrades, for she has sinned. It's been 3 weeks since our last exchange. She stopped me after class, hands brushing wisps of honey hair off her forehead, nervous compliment to confession. I really admire your work, your spirit, how you don't let blindness get you down. Do I tell her blindness gets me up? She supposes it's all to do with her childhood. She had something of a girl crush on Helen Keller. Even learned a little Braille, very little. She can't read the bathroom signs, but she knows those tiny dots are for blind people.
Now for this week's final item, how to get some of Emily's writings, including how to watch a video of the TED Talk she gave, and how to reach her if you have any questions or comments.
So if people would like to find some of your writings, where would you send them?
I would send them to my blog. So you can visit my blog. It's called On the Blink, and the web address is areyouseeingthis@wordpress.com, areyouseeingthis.wordpress.com. I have all of my online publications linked there. I have my social media linked there as well.
And if people just prefer to find you directly through Facebook or Twitter, where would they find you?
You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/author Emily K. Michael. That's EmilyKMichael. And you can find me on Twitter as Maudwyn Arendelle, MODWYNEARENDEL.
I assume there's a story behind that name.
Yes, there is. When I was in grad school, I took a course in Old English, which is, if you think of Beowulf, it's Anglo-Saxon. It was spoken from 449 AD to about 1066 AD. When we took that class, we had to choose Anglo-Saxon names. And so my Anglo-Saxon name was Maudwyn. And then Arendelle was that of a Anglo-Saxon poem that I really liked.
If people want to contact you and ask you any questions, how would you suggest they do that?
There's a page on my blog that says About Emily K. Michael. At the bottom of that page, there's a contact form. So you can just fill in your information, and then that sends an email directly to me.
And if you're looking for any of that contact information or the URLs, just go to the show notes for this episode at www.eyesonsuccess.net. And remember, you can use our search tool to look for interviews we've done with other writers, authors, etc., by putting one of those terms into the search field. Also, if you want to find interviews with blind people in other interesting professions or careers, just put in the word careers or jobs, and you'll find a lot of those types of shows.
That's it for show number 1648. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about the Orbit Reader 20. This is a new, inexpensive, portable Braille display from the American Printing House for the Blind. And we will be speaking with blind engineer Ken Perry, who is excited to be the project lead for developing this new device. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-210-8094.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey, and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. Browse the full archive of programs, find instructions for subscribing to the podcasts, and much more at www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also find us on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and on audioboom.com, @EyesOnSuccess, or Twitter @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success, and have a nice day.